take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Yeah, motherfucker. Bring that shit.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your dark night of the soul of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonico.
We're going to start this right, the way everything in hip-hop should start. I'm going to tell you like I tell these bitches every day. I'm like a condom. If you don't with me, you die. Y'all motherfuckers come to the tunnel. Thinking it's a good idea.
It's a tough week, a tough couple weeks in New York hip-hop live shows. I am here with Joe Coscarelli, our pop music reporter, Minya Oh of Misinfo.tv, Joey Manda, president, Urban Music, Interscope Records, and OG in the 90s and 2000s club scene in New York. We're here to talk about some serious things. There was an incident that happened at Irving Plaza. Troy Ave, the rapper, was captured on video firing off in the VIP room. There have been three injuries, and Troy Ave's bodyguard, Ronald McFadder, was killed in the shooting. As a result, there has been NYPD backlash in a very 1990s kind of way. Commissioner Bratton calling rappers thugs. Live Nation recently canceled a whole slate of hip-hop shows that were scheduled to go down at Irving Plaza, along with some butt-covering rock shows to make them seem not racist, is my guess. We're here today because we want to talk a little bit about what's happening in the current moment in New York hip-hop live shows and clubs, but also to take it back to the 90s, where I think the current fear and antagonism really stems from. So, Joe, let's start off with what's happening news-wise right now.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about the events at Irving Plaza and then what spilled out afterwards.
So this was now last Wednesday yep. night, I believe. T.I. was headlining a show. He had been on, I think, the Tonight Show earlier.
Getting a little extra show money.
Just getting a little extra money, a one-off show featuring some, you know, some New York rappers opening
Uncle
up.
Murda,
Uncle
Mano.
Murda, Mano, some other names on
Anderson
that bill.
I think Anderson Paak was on that
Anderson
bill.
Anderson Paak. And I guess right before the headlining set, there was some chaos. Some shots were fired. There's, you know, backstage video, scuffle, as you said, mm-hmm. one death. Troy Ave has been charged so far with attempted murder and reckless endangerment for mm-hmm. firing into the crowd. NYPD is currently doing ballistics tests on the shells that they found.
And they found guns in the stash spot in his in the car
they
that
found
was driven,
three guns,
driven to the hospital.
Three guns in the car that drove Troy Ave to the hospital. Troy Ave's lawyers claiming self-defense, saying that the shot we're seeing on the video was not the shot that killed the bodyguard, not the shot that hit Troy in the leg, but that perhaps these were retaliation or some sort of – there had been something going on before. Maybe mm-hmm. Troy was already shot when we see him on the video. Mm-hmm. A lot of open questions. But if the ballistics come back and the shot that killed McFadder is from one of these guns that Troy has, it's possible he could be charged with the murder of his own, as he says, a lifelong friend.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, immediately after that, the heat is turned up and Bratton's on the radio, you know, 7 a.m. the next morning saying this is what happens with these so-called artists. You know, the violence manifests itself at the shows. They're glorifying violence and drug use.
Thugs.
And they're thugs. So, you know, he made it seem like this is – that these shows are often dangerous. Now, that's an open question. I mean, the NYPD refused to give us any sort of data about what sort of violent incidents occur at these shows.
Mm-hmm.
They had, you know, declined to speak – with us about it. But, you know, if you follow news reports, these things, especially in New York, you know, it's not very common.
The idea of a rap concert in New York City, there being violence at it, seems a little bit of an antiquated thing. It does feel like a relic of an earlier era. The lawlessness that we would have thought about in the 80s and 90s obviously has been squelched both internally by the genre, but also externally by police presence and surveillance and whatnot. And so I'm wondering a little bit about what you guys thought about the current situation and how out of character it seemed for the contemporary moment in this city, even though you moved.
I would say that, yeah, I want to make sure that we remind everybody in this podcast about Joey's illustrious, infamous past because now he's Hollywood.
Living the great life.
Hollywood Joy IE. But
I didn't forget you people. Don't worry.
But I think that it's not that surprising for Bratton to say those kinds of statements because think of, you know, he's an old school guy.
Yeah, I mean, a product of that era.
Right. So 20 years to him is a blip. Mm-hmm. And he's still living in those days when it was wild out here.
When he was a police commissioner here the first
time. Yeah. So for him to kind of make this blanket statement is not that crazy. What is kind of interesting is that especially when you were on social media when that statement was made and in the aftermath of the Irving Plaza incident, there were way more people who call themselves hip-hop fans who kind of agreed with him because of the way that people are split.
And in the then current you saw, hip-hop moment.
Yes. Yeah. And then you also see Mayor de Blasio quickly step in and try to mitigate that that statement by saying, like, no, he didn't really mean all hip-hop. There's lots of positive hip-hop. Whereas in the past, that sort of remedy statement would not have
We'll see de Blasio at the Brooklyn Hip-Hop Festival this summer.
It's a great soundbite for Bratton, right? Everything that's happened with the NYPD, cops in America overall recently, like, this is a better thing for him to talk about. Like, he wants people focused on
anything other than cops.
Yeah, anything other than, you know, police brutality and Black Lives Matter. He wants people to talk about a shooting at a rap show. That's a great soundbite. It's great to take the attention and shift the conversation. And I think that it's also, you know, geography has a lot to do with it. It happened in Gramercy Park. I think if this happened at Lust in Brooklyn, I don't think anybody would be talking about it at this level. I think shootings at rap shows and violence in rap and, oh, my God, this is crazy, is always a good soundbite for the police commissioner.
It's familiar for him. I mean, this is a guy who lived through the time when, you know, basically going to a rap show in New York was maybe a more dangerous proposition. Going to a nightclub and a hip-hop concert was a more dangerous proposition. And I think a guy like Bratton built his reputation off of, like, being tough, quote-unquote, on things like this. And so for him, it's like slipping into auto mode. He just knows how to talk that language, even though, as our mayor points out, the genre has changed, but also the genre has changed in more ways than just there's being positive rap now.
The other thing that Bratton did was he sort of alluded to, you know, he said, we got one of these characters last year in reference to Bobby Shmurda, who, you know, up-and-coming Brooklyn rapper, you know, right as he hits it big, him and his neighborhood
crew,
friends, his whole crew, GS9, get busted on gang conspiracy charges. But he's sort of fudging the line here where he's drawing the connection between rap shows, rap live events, and this, you know, alleged gang activity that was happening sort of outside of music. And that's where a lot of this gets blurry because, you know, you have kids who maybe started in one realm of their life, and then as they move into fame,
but the rest of their
some
crew
of it
is
bleeds
not,
over.
Yeah.
And Bratton, you know, he was actually a little bit more nuanced in his discussion of that phenomenon specifically, where, you know, you might be transcending your past, but you haven't fully caught up. And I think we saw that in the Shmurda case. But whether that actually means violence is manifesting commonly at rap shows is a separate question.
Yeah.
It's not. And I think Bratton knows that. I think, you know, NYPD as a whole know that. I remember Giuliani's whole thing about, you know, just shutting down nightlife in general in New York, but definitely any clubs that had, you know, rap music were first on his list. And I think, you know, it's definitely loosened up since then. And I don't think there's been more violence per se. I think it's actually a much calmer environment. I remember, you know, Irving Plaza, you know, didn't just open in the past few years. That's been there forever. And they didn't even have rap shows a long time ago.
Right.
And these venues weren't even, you know, down to do these shows. So now they're doing them. And, you know, it's super unfortunate that there was a shooting at any show and anyone got hit. But, you know, I think if you look at if you pull up the metrics, which, you know, sounds like you tried to do, I think it's overall, you know, safe. It's a safe environment.
But let's talk about this historical antagonism, because I think part of the reason it's safe now is because there are these sort of systemic forces that have been in play for the last two decades. In part, they're sort of aggressive and persistent surveillance in a New York context, persistent surveillance by New York Police Department, whether it's, you know, hip hop cops specifically or just really, really policing nightlife aggressively. And then you also have the shift in the genre. You know, the genre is much more of a global concern right now. It's much more, it's more melodic and less rough. And, you know, the crowds that it draws are very different. And so I think you have changes in the music and changes in the policing that have created this environment where it seems striking to us that there's a shooting at a rap show in 2016. But let's talk about the 90s. Let's talk about when things were a little bit more raw. I'm curious to know what was your guys' experiences, both in actual nightlife and at concerts, in terms of policing of those events, and how aggressive was that at the time when rap was, you know, sort of your peak Bad Boy era into hip-hop pop era of the early 2000s?
Well, when I first started working for Peter Gation, who owned the Tunnel, Palladium, Limelight, Club USA at the time, mm-hmm. it was 1993, and there was a rule, and NYPD was very clear about it. If you talk about a night that you're going to have rap music and have any kind of, you know, rappers host or perform or anything, if you talk about that on the radio, we're not going to let you open up. So, you know, there'd be some nights. I mean, Flex was doing Fridays at the Palladium. That he used to kind of mention on the radio, but they wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't be big, you know, promotion.
They wouldn't advertise
it. It would kind of still be word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And Tunnel was definitely, you know, at the end, before it closed, then they would talk about it on the radio, and it would be the first 500 girls free and all that other stuff. For the first few years when it was Mecca and it was Jessica Rosenblum's party, if somebody mentioned it on the radio by accident, if Jay-Z was up at Hot 97 and he accidentally mentioned it, we might not be able to open because it was understood that it was, you know, it was a different time.
Did you?
I think the music was more dangerous. I think the environment mm-hmm. was more dangerous.
Was there like an NYPD, like a point person or a group of officers who was specifically tasked to you guys?
No, there wasn't any hip hop police yet. It was more by precinct. So the Tunnel, I mean, I don't remember now what precinct mm-hmm. was where, but the Palladium obviously had the captain of that precinct, mm-hmm. who, you know, usually the night captain, whoever's on the shift when mm-hmm. the club is open would come by and kind
of
like,
really?
You know, knew
so
they had
the
a security.
Lanes of communication were open.
Yeah. Yeah, always. Yeah, they'd come by and say, so, you know, Puff was on the radio and he said he's having, you know, a party here next week. You know, that doesn't seem good. You know, that doesn't seem. And by the way, the parties were mostly safe at the, even
sure.
even then. So, you know, I don't want to paint the wrong picture. Mm-hmm. Like it was, you know, every time the club opened, there was violence. But
you guys
were.
Well.
Yeah, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. But you guys
we
were
don't
being,
have the figures in front of
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
But you guys, but basically, you guys were being surveilled even at that point. Like you were being watched closely.
Absolutely.
And they
yeah,
had.
Yeah, they were tuned in. They were tuned in even before, like, again, even before there was the hip hop cops, they were tuned in to what artists were, you know, what was being promoted, what was going to happen at the club. Like they
mm-hmm.
wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even at the Palladium, I remember. You know, if we were planning a show, it could be Queen, you know, at the time, Queen Latifah or Naughty by Nature or Tribe Called Quest on New Year's Eve. You know, a call would get made from the club to the precinct like, hey, this is going to be our show this night. You know, just letting you know, just as a courtesy, because, you know, it was definitely a, yo, let's try to keep the cops cool.
And mm-hmm. this has only picked up, I think, in the internet era because yeah. now you have, you know, law enforcement on social media. They know they're on Instagram. They're seeing what parties are going on. And the young promoters that I talked to, you know, for
ask,
our story
yeah.
this week said, you know, we'll be throwing a party with a bubbling up internet rapper and the cops know more about him than most rap
yeah.
fans do. You know, you get a guy who maybe has claimed to have gang affiliation and the police will call, the promoters will call the venues and they'll say, you know, keep an eye out on this guy. And the promoters are frankly sort of shocked because they're like, you know, we can't even get enough people to come to the show because nobody knows who this is. But the NYPD are aware of associated
yeah they
baggage,
know they know
alleged baggage.
Yeah, and they know who has, you know, who doesn't like who has
yeah.
beef
mm-hmm.
who, you know, who's affiliated with what. To your point, now with the internet, it's not, you can't have a word of mouth show,
right?
Because
mm-hmm.
you
right.
know the way it spreads around, it's word of mouth on super steroids, right?
Mm-hmm. So Joe, you handled Palladium and Tunnel also.
Palladium and Tunnel mostly, yeah.
Was the relationship between you guys and the police, you talked about the clubs would reach out to the cops to say this was happening, things were happening. Was it more collaborative or was it more adversarial?
It was kind of fake cool, and then if something popped off, it was definitely adversarial at that
yeah.
point, especially if a cop, if they felt like a cop was in danger from mm-hmm. trying to break it up. I mean, we had great security, which is why we had the run that we had, and, you know, security was able to handle most things. But you couldn't not only mention the Tunnel on Sunday or a rap show on the radio because of, you know, fears of, you know, that something would pop off. It was also because 10,000 people would show up.
Right.
Because hip-hop hadn't crossed all the way mainstream yet. Mm-hmm. So it was still like, you know, something got said on the radio, you know, literally 10,000 people. Would
so when you had crowds at that level, what were the security procedures in place? Was it metal detectors, outside security?
It was
firms?
Metal detectors. It was, everything was...
Intense frisking.
It was intense frisking. Intense. It was take your shoes off. It was, you know, it was people that security identified as, you know, he's gotten into a few things here, or, you know, we caught him trying to come in with such and such, so he's banned. There was, you know,
a lot
there was also
them.
A list like that, mm-hmm. which then, you know, people would try to get unbanned, and that would be a whole nother thing.
The tunnel era was representative of a lot of different things, because for one, like Joey was saying, you couldn't mention things on the radio, so the entire social network was flyers and word of mouth,
mm-hmm.
and people would show up. And they also knew, because it almost felt like a community of tunnel partiers. Mm-hmm. Every Sunday, you're seeing a lot of the same people, except for the people who got banned.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still circling the block anyways.
Right.
But, you know...
Menu was on that ban list, by the way, for years.
You knew that you referred to the security force that was in place. That kind of took the place of... like a vigilante police force to me.
Mm-hmm.
They did a lot of things, and I wrote a story on the tunnel in Vibe in 1999. We talked to a lot of people off the record about a certain room that security guards would take people,
mm-hmm.
Like, you know, to bounce them off of,
mm-hmm.
for a little while if they got out of line. And, you know, there were
never
a lot
heard
of
that room.
Yeah, right.
Sounds like
right.
Guantanamo Bay.
There's a lot of barriers of entry. So, you know, I think that there was a lot of violence that happened, but it wasn't unexpected. And the crowd was also going there knowing, like signing a invisible authorization.
If such a room existed, that is a way of basically avoiding police interaction. That's
exactly.
Basically solving the problem before police.
Internally. No, we always, I wasn't, you know, I'm obviously wasn't a security guard, but, you know, I did do the door at the tunnel. That is mm-hmm. how I started. And security would always try to contain it. You know, the cops getting involved in anything was always the last result.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, you know, people rushing the door because there was too many people outside
mm-hmm.
or the party was too crazy. Because it was Puff or Jay or DMX, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the people that went to clubs, the average club goer, show, you know, rap show goer, and by the way, there was much less rap shows at that point.
Right.
Rap, you know, obviously there had been tours and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, there was Hard Knock Life or mm-hmm. Rough Riders Cash Money in the 90s and all that stuff. And there was, you know, big tours in the late 80s.
Was Tramps all going at that point?
Tramps was going, yeah, in mm-hmm. the 90s. But the people that went to a tunnel on Sunday, we're not, you know, you probably go to the most shows mm-hmm. out of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what's the average age if you go to a rap show.
Early 20s, maybe?
Yeah, I feel like Tunnel was a little bit older.
Yeah.
I think it was a little bit older.
Well,
it was obviously people with, you know, with more money in their pocket.
You had to know somebody, or you had to pay $75, or if you came after a certain time, it was like $300.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was a more serious caliber person
mm-hmm.
than the kid that goes to the...
money to spend. You had to roll up in a certain car. You had to wear the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that the tunnel was in an area that was completely desolate.
Right.
Now it's the meatpacking district.
Right. No, now it's West Chelsea.
Right.
But then there was nothing else to threaten
mm-hmm.
sort of the status quo of the city.
So when you did
the High Line was a train yard.
Right.
When you did see incidents, where was it stemming from? Was it affiliated with the artists? What did it trickle down from there? Was
yeah.
it small time stuff?
Sometimes it was. Sometimes it was. You know, I mean, listen, I also didn't just work on nights that played hip hop. You know, I worked on other nights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started because I threw parties in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
Where hip hop was played and also house music
right.
was played, and you know. So Saturday nights at the Palladium, a good example. I worked there, too, and that was we had a hip-hop room, and later Flex, you know, came and did guest sets.
Mm-hmm.
But that was house music, and there would be the same, you know.
Same
would there'd be stabbings on Saturday night.
Yeah.
There would definitely be, you know, a lot of drugs. A lot of drugs, a lot of people passing out,
yep.
some ODs, you know, stuff that happens at festivals now.
Yeah, sure.
That was a big issue to the cops as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it wasn't limited to hip-hop shows?
Never, mm-hmm. never. I mean, it's gatherings of people right. in affluent Manhattan neighborhoods is a big part of it.
So you think a lot of it has to do with, obviously, where the location. We were talking a little bit before about Irving Plaza, and you said if it was at Lust, this no one would care, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of it is geography. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I remember when Giuliani was in office and they had M2 and those clubs that were on that one block on like 27th and on the west side.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, or the Meatpacking District. You know, obviously it's a super expensive neighborhood, but they try to like kind of contain it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they want clubs on every other. Right.
They
every
want
other
industrial
block.
Blocks.
Yeah. Right.
A lot could happen. It was just wildness. People, you know, flooding out of the clubs afterwards, you know, in a drunken stupor. And, you know, that's when girls would get picked up and disappear.
And at this time, you know, I hate to say in the 90s, it's obviously an overused phrase in music right now. But community boards, too, were a big part of this. I remember, I remember on 21st Street when they closed Cheetah and they had an issue with Justin's, which was Puffy's restaurant on 21st Street, that community boards would definitely be the ones, even if the, you know, you asked before about the relationship between, you know, these clubs and the police. The relationship would be cool and fake cool, but then the community board would definitely be the ones showing up. There'd be some dude or some lady on the community board that would show up at the police precinct the morning after every show and say, hey, a car got broken into or I felt unsafe. I was walking my dog.
Right.
You know, some cops would be like, well, you shouldn't walk, you know, your dog at 3 a.m. And some people would be like, oh, yeah, I guess we got to deal with this. And,
but it was like moving towards the middle, you know, like the edges were moving towards the middle. The outer boroughs were moving towards the middle. Mm-hmm. And I remember I lived in Harlem at the time and there were a lot of kids in my area that never went downtown at all, not to shop. If they bought Louis or Gucci, it was on 125th Street at one store that must have been getting it like secondhand. And they only went to the tunnel.
Is it the place that Cam went? The one that's right to the right of the Apollo?
Yeah. Apollo Express. And, you know, but once it started sort of blending into other parts of the city, you mentioned like Tramps. Tramps was playing all different types of, it was just a music venue. But the one time I remember, the first time I ever really hung out with M.O.P., it was at a show at Tramps. They were brand new. And the end of the show, I just remember them swinging the mic stands and hitting people in the head because a fight had broken out. And I was like hiding behind the DJ tables. And no one ever wrote about that. There were no police. Everything was handled within.
No one tweeting from there.
No one
Snapchatting.
Yeah. And there was no footage because there were so fewer cameras in general. There were no cameras.
Right.
Surveillance was like for really expensive buildings.
So I think the other thing we've seen, you know, in the time since then is, you know, you're talking about nightclubs mostly. Now rap has become so professionalized where, you know, they're in these professionalized venues. You know, Live Nation is the biggest concert promoter in the world. And they're the ones, you know, running shows at Irving Plaza, at Gramercy Theater, at that sort of thing. And, you know, it's Train one night, rock band, you know, for older white people.
All our real legends went to the Train show last night.
And then it's Vince Staples or whatever it is. And you have these mesh of worlds. And I think the other thing that's happened is to make it safer, in addition to, you know, the city has become less violent in general. Because of that era, there are more rules put on a rap show in a place that has more than just rap. I think there's a higher bar to clear security-wise. And that's why, you know, if you go see War on Drugs at Music Hall of Williamsburg, you're not going to get patted down.
Of course not.
No one's going to look in your bag. You're just going to stroll right in. But if you go see, you know, 21 Savage at Webster Hall, it's going to be a different vibe security.
Or my personal favorite is when I went to see Tyler the Creator once at Music Hall of Williamsburg, which is hilarious. Tyler the Creator is not a violent, like, there's nothing violent about Odd Future or any of that stuff in any real way. The police presence, this was maybe 3 years ago, and I was like stupefied. There was like 10 squad cars on the block. They had set up barriers outside. I mean, I've never seen that.
And that's the broad brush that
all this stuff gets painted
security
with.
And law enforcement doesn't necessarily know the nuances of the difference between Tyler the Creator and a 21 Savage.
They might not. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. A thing that we were talking about earlier before we started, there are always these narrative moments in hip hop where uptown comes downtown. And the one that I think many people think about is, you know, hip hop 1.0, where it's late 70s into the early 80s, and, you know, everybody's coming to Danceteria or the Roxy or whatever, and you have these moments of cultural crossover. But then I think when rap really becomes a major cultural concern, and all of a sudden you have, like, you know, Life on Bleecker in, like, 98 and 99, like, right at the center of downtown.
Shout out Friday Nights at Life.
I mean, this is, you know, these are major things, you know, and then that ends up on the cover of New York Magazine and stuff like that. Talk to me a little bit about that moment, because I wonder if a lot of the scrutiny that we saw from, like, the, say, late 90s, like 96, 97, into the early 2000s, had to do with this idea of uptown and downtown merging in a very specific way at that moment.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think people that, you know, I think people that live in downtown Manhattan did not want to see a whole bunch of clubs playing rap music, a whole bunch of black people coming downtown or coming in from Brooklyn or Queens or, you know, coming down from the Bronx or wherever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, why are they here on Tuesday night? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you're talking about different, also, you know, different security measures on for rap shows than a train show or, you know, or whatever, I think, you know, it's all has a touch of racism to it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all kind of like, do they have to be here? You know, I live here. I just bought this condo for $3.8 million. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do they have to have a rap show in my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. You know, do all these black people have to congregate here?
Right. Not on my block. It's NIMBY. Right. It's not on my block.
Yeah.
But that moment was also, that was probably the moment of peak money in terms of how hip-hop had evolved. And also, I would imagine, peak antagonism between police and hip-hop promoters and live events. Is that, did it feel that way at the time?
Yeah, it felt that way because of what I said earlier about, you know, if a show got mentioned on the radio, 10,000 people would show up. Mm-hmm. Now there's rap shows almost every night. And, you know, to your point earlier, Joe, it's like, you know, now it's a real, rap is a real part of the touring industry and hard tickets.
Business.
Mostly rap music, that was a club night.
Yeah.
And a rapper, you know, performing, but it wasn't a hard ticket and it wasn't as, you know, it wasn't as organized in a traditional touring way.
But you also can't have a club night if you're in Ibiza or if you're in Brooklyn or if you're in, you know, Hoboken without playing hip hop.
Like, right. Not any,
whether
not
it's
at
like
that point.
White people, Euros, you know, nobody.
And that was a cultural shift because, I mean, I think as recently as probably the mid-90s, you could, I mean, I remember going to Life at one point and being like, it was not the wrong night. Right, I went on the wrong night one night and I was like, this is weird. This is just like a literal weird club night and they're not playing any records I want to hear.
Club owners made a, they were very strategic about playing rap only on certain nights. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want the club to get perceived as that's a rap club
and scare
the white people away and scare the Eurotrash away. They were really scared about, you know, scaring them away.
But you still see bars in New York, you know, that maybe they take rap out of the jukebox. They don't have an after party there. Or even Webster Hall, you know, recently canceled House Party, its weekly rap event. Mm. And, you know, I spoke to one of the promoters there and he said, you know, it's hard to keep something like this going because there's a constant tension between the venue, security, the police, the artists who feel profiled, the fans who feel profiled. And these things still go on, but it's quieter. You know, you get a dress code or you get a, you know, a bar saying, you know, we're canceling this party. Mm-hmm. And those perceptions are still around. They're just maybe pushed a little deeper now because people know it's unacceptable to say.
There were a lot of things that happened in 99 that I think contributed to this sort of antagonism, right? I mean, I think that's when the hip-hop cops actually became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also the year of Jay-Z versus Un.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, even earlier than that, the East Coast, West Coast thing definitely raised, you know, the NYPD went crazy with that.
Mm-hmm. Biggie, you know, Biggie's funeral, Biggie's passing. Club New York with Puff and J-Lo in the mix. I mean, that was like, that suddenly took...
Then you're in People magazine.
Yes, that took things where there were hip-hop celebrities who are now crossing into mainstream and mainstream awareness, now with, you know, superstar Hollywood actresses.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still tied in with people that, you know, they came up with, criminal elements that they, you know, had to be friends with and you know, obviously... got a lot of street cred from, and then things happen in clubs that, you know, are right next to them or involve them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that was a very, very different and sort of changing year, whereas now, you know, there are things like Coachella and Governor's Ball where every genre of music is mixed in. And yet, you know, there's a lot of things that happen. It's not violence, but it's people ODing and things like that that doesn't get the same
scrutiny.
Yeah, it doesn't it doesn't cause the same, you know,
uproar. So that felt, that era felt to you like peak police antagonism.
Definitely.
Definitely.
Mid to late 90s for sure.
But meanwhile, you could go to a club that was, or a venue that was like, I went to a Wu-Tang show and it was way out in Queens. You knew that something was happening way on the other side, like maybe there was gunshots and everybody sort of shifted to the other side. The show kept going and you just sort of assumed that, you know.
Were police as heavy and an event like that as they would have been if Wu-Tang was playing at Ring Plaza or somewhere downtown?
No, they then had a release party at Webster Hall and it was a completely different scenario.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
I'm curious, what do you think, because ultimately police antagonism sort of remains, but the shows did change over the course of the 2000s. Things didn't, they became less rowdy. They became, you know, all the things you're talking about that happened in 99, you couldn't look at, say, 2005 and be like, oh, there's three equivalent things. The genre had changed and the sort of locales had changed and the energy had changed. What do you think was shifting either in the music or in the presentation?
I was just going to say that it was complete. It's completely because of the music and how mainstream it became and, you know, the shift in you know, the sensibility of it.
Think about the police force right now. What do you think they listen to?
Of course.
They listen to hip-hop.
Yeah.
So they're aware. Like, you know, we did a an event at our store, which was DJ Khaled.
Yep.
The fan base, which was like 1,000 kids, were all there. But they were, like, very mixed. Mostly white kids. And then some Asian, some black, some Spanish. We did another event, which was a private party for Fila with Rakim. The insurance that we had to get for Rakim was so much more expensive than this, like, $1,000 shut down the block Khaled event. And that was strictly because there's just this stigma of, like, hip-hop as opposed to...
And also, that's race. Right. I mean, you know, DJ Khaled is...
Yeah, who are the fans of this arts? What kind of people is this going
to
bring?
I think we have to... Everyone that's listening to this needs to be clear. Like, this definitely is a racist element
absolutely.
To this.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, you talk about how the music has changed. I mean, let's talk about that sort of 50 into post-50 era. Because, I mean, to me, the transition point, especially in a New York framework, is 51.0 versus 52.0 and then Ja. Like, basically, when Ja basically takes the 50 model, is like, I don't even need to be tough. Like, I'm basically just going to make the soft songs. And then you have your Murder, Inc. run. And then you basically, like, that's the softening of New York rap in that particular time frame. But that's, to me, is when the sound of the city changes and also the city's nightlife begins to evolve. Melody comes to the forefront. Crowds become much more diverse. These things are evolving. This is, like, 2002 to 2005, basically.
What year was 808s and Heartbreaks?
A little bit after that, I think.
I know every conversation about rap changing goes back to 808s. It's the only reason I was asking.
Only if Caramonica's writing it.
Hey, I can't help it.
I mean, the irony is that Ja caught his gun charge after he was soft.
Much after.
Right.
The Feds case came after that. And, you know.
But it all dialed. But the Feds case all went back much, much earlier. It wasn't...
To the late 90s.
Yeah. I mean, the Feds case, it's not like they just got something on him out of nowhere.
Yeah, okay.
Like, the Feds case was... And the gun charge, yeah. But, like, the Feds case was...
Yeah.
Grandfathered in from the old era.
True.
So, do you feel like the way that the music was changing in those years, what did you see in the nightlife and in the concert space during those years?
Well, I was kind of out of it, you know, in the early 2000s. But, you know, just musically, like you're saying, I guess... You know, Get Rich or Die Trying was the height of dangerous rap.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of changed to more melodic, you know, the infusion of R&B.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The real infusion of R&B into rap music.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that...
Right, not the mixing of R&B and rap, but the actual infusion of R&B into rap, which is really the difference.
You know,
that's
funny.
The intellectual change.
A few years ago, I think 2013, there was four people shot at a Fat Trail show at SOBs. And in the Times story from that time, you know, they ask his manager, you know, did this have to do with Fat Trail? And he says, this didn't have anything to do with us. Most of our fans are females. That was his line, which is basically saying, like, you know, we don't have anything to do with whatever tough guy stuff is going on out there.
I was not at the Fat Trail show, but I just...
I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I was going to say,
hilarious,
it seemed like perhaps.
Because in the history of man, it's mostly females who have been the instigation for
but you know, but the fact that he saw that as his,
cover
right,
is like tells you something, I think, about the way the music and the crowds changed.
What a great quote. Great quote.
Kind of like, oh, skinny jeans. I can't even fit a gun in skinny jeans. Exactly. Right.
Now, I guess my question is, you know, we see these cancellations already, you know, a week later we get four rap shows canceled. You know, the spotlight is on. The spot Summer Jams this weekend, you know, if anything happens, it's going to be all over the local news. Like, how does hip-hop is so diffuse now. Like, how do people react? How do the artists react? How do, you know, the labels sort of try and the promoters try and keep things in line to let this die down?
You're right. I'm sure Summer Jam is always under the microscope.
And especially after last year.
Because of history, and especially after last year, especially after last Wednesday. Mm-hmm. You've been to a football game lately, though?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
It doesn't, to me, you know, I went to, you know, Drake and Future. I went to J. Cole's run last summer, like, those feel as safe or safer to me than going to the Giants versus the Eagles.
Yeah, but the stigma is still there.
I mean, think of who you just named. Think of who you just named.
Yeah.
You literally out here trying to compare like a J. Cole show to like, I mean, that's not like 50 at Nassau Coliseum in 04. I mean, it's like, it's a different,
well,
it's a different beast.
I'm talking about now.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think when you take a step back and, you know, 60,000 people gather someplace, you know, a rap show, you know, rap concerts, you know, whether it's a Kanye tour, mm-hmm. Drake, Cole, whatever it is, I don't think those are, you know, those seem super safe to me.
But also the amount of scrutiny that I'm sure we're going to see on Sunday at Summer Jam. I mean, last year was like an even before things popped off, mm-hmm. it was severely policed, I thought, especially in comparison to previous years.
Yeah.
And I think this year is only going to be worse.
Oh, sure. I mean, you take the fact that state police showed up in riot gear last year. You know, there were some skirmishes at the
but
entrance.
The state police have been at Summer Jam
of course.
For a decade with AK-47s and riot gear on.
Yeah.
You get the vibe from some of those guys that they want it to happen, that they're there for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it definitely feels like a militia presence at Summer Jam.
Do you feel like there's a collective feeling among hip-hop fans that, you know, we have to make sure that this goes off without a hitch because all the eyes are on us? Or is it not that
I think it's at the front of everyone's mind for Sunday and every rap show right now.
At hip-hop shows on that level, you're seeing way more younger fans. You're seeing kids and you're seeing more mixed crowds. The thing that's...
But every rap show is a mixed crowd. Right,
but... Mm-hmm. Think about the difference in the audience between a small club gig, which would cost maybe $10 to get into, versus a $75, $150 mega show at a big amphitheater. I mean,
that a high school kid, their parent is taking him,
exactly,
dropping them off and picking up. Yeah, yeah.
That's where the culture kind of suffers because a lot of the smaller gigs, where that's how you build your career. How can those afford the insurance, and if they don't have security, they need to start installing security. Mm-hmm. That's where it sort of starts changing.
And when we talk about live hip hop, I mean, you know, you were mentioning earlier the sort of big tours of the late 90s and your Cash Money Rough Rider tour, things of that nature. I'm wondering about the state of live hip hop, both in New York and more broadly speaking, outside of the city and outside of the major urban centers. You know, you go down south, you know, there's what could be referred to as a Chitlin circuit for Southern rappers. You know, that's where Boosie gets his money. That's where Kodak Black, when he's not in jail, gets his money. Like
Gotti pre-DMs.
Yeah, Gotti, exactly, before he's
upgraded.
Yeah,
yeah. So,
but, you know, those are not hard ticket shows.
Yeah, there's two different. There's the secure the brown paper bag kind of show at the club. And then there's the hard ticket, you know, either amphitheater, you know, shed or arena and, you know, for the very chosen few stadium.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And the promoters that I talked to after the Irving shooting said, you know, we're going to see a lot more of the strip club, nightclub, no ticket shows and a lot fewer that have to be signed off on by Live Nation.
And but what's interesting is with the professionalization of hip hop.
That's bad.
Like, it's your job. Like, it's part of your job. You want your artists major label artists to sell hard tickets. You want them to be viable touring concerns.
Super important.
And you want to get them out of the brown bag shows and into the venue shows.
Absolutely. Any artist in any genre of music, you know, the goal is to sell, you know, clubs, theaters, amphitheaters, arenas, and then stadiums. You know, that's always the goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, it's a shame if any of this deters, you know. makes that harder than it already is. Because, by the way, it's really hard. Even if there's no violence or there's none of this going on, it's super hard to build a touring base.
How much of a setback does it feel like? Have you had conversations internally at your label in the last week? Like, does it feel already like a setback?
I think everyone's just talking about, hey, New York's, you know, trying to shut down every show right now.
Mm-hmm. And you think it'll pass?
I think it always passes. Because there'll be a bunch of shows that nothing will happen at. There'll be a huge police presence, and there'll be, you know, the community board will come, and, you know, reporters will come cover it. And it'll be a great show, and it'll go off, you know, without any kind of issue. Mm-hmm. And that'll happen a bunch of times. And then something else will happen, and it'll be on the cover of the newspaper, and everyone will move on.
I would hate if this pushes hip-hop into a larger gap between the, half up front and half after the show,
right.
Walk through the club show, or that type of rapper, versus the only do big festivals rapper.
Right.
Because the price of the ticket is... you know, not sustainable for
it's
any
prohibitive.
Regular fan.
Mm-hmm.
You need those Webster Hall, those
$25
shows.
The other thing is that you're talking about certain mega tours that happened, 10, 15 years ago. Those were horrible rap shows, by the way.
Wait, Cash Money Rough Ride was not a horrible rap show.
I thought it was awesome.
The actual, okay, we all enjoyed it.
Hard Knock Life.
Yo, Helicopter went right over my head.
But aesthetically.
I am the happiest I've ever been.
But aesthetically, it was a dude walking back and forth with 100
no
people
set,
behind him.
There was
no set.
Sound, no
I
sound.
I watched DMX cry on stage.
He
what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But you know what she's saying.
He prayed and cried.
At this point,
he doesn't
now
need production, man. You
people
are losing it.
They've elevated their live performance, finally, and now we won't be able to see them because
we
it
need
won't
to.
Be,
we need to see it. And listen, you know, again, getting back, you know, the Forest Hills Drive tour last summer, which was Cole, Big Sean, YG, Jeremiah, that to me was perfect. You know, it's not like you go into a festival and you're seeing a bunch of stuff that, you know, a few things you want to see and a bunch of stuff you don't have to see. And it's not, you know, going to a festival is a bit overwhelming if you're just trying to see one or two artists. But, you know, we need shows that are geared towards people that want to see a mixture of great rappers. You know?
I'm just going to make you disclose your professional relationship with J. Cole at this moment.
You're in business with him.
I'm in business with him, but that's not why. But honestly, that's not why I said it, though. I mean, YG.
I believe your heart.
You should believe my heart.
I do.
But listen, he had YG on the tour, and everybody, you know, before the tour, everyone was like, you know, hey, should YG be on this tour? Because, you know, he's obviously has an element of danger to him, and, you know, the shooting happened and all that other stuff, and it tour went on without a problem.
Well, YG's a pro.
Yeah.
YG's a pro. I mean, yeah. I can't, you know, YG's also in a tough spot where seems like the element around him is still vibrant and alive, unfortunately. But YG himself is a pro. I want to thank you guys for coming and sharing all the war stories from back in the day. Joey IE, Minya O.
Minya doesn't have to disclose her professional relationships with anybody.
I would like, yes, before we go, Minya, what would you like to disclose?
I am the secret keeper of hip hop.
That's true.
I've held many secrets, including some of the ones from the tunnel. I mean, wow.
You're the fifth member of Dipset.
Yeah. true.
The Minya O memoir in 2037 will be an instant bestseller, and the Lifetime movie based on it is going to be a real hitter.
I don't know. Is Lucy Liu still going to be
working
at that point?
Lucy Liu Jr., maybe.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for listening to the New York Times Popcast. Thanks to all of our guests. Check out every Popcast episode ever at nytimes.com/popcast. You can listen to us on iTunes, on Audio Boom, on Stitcher. Check out our Spotify playlist. Our producers are Pedro Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez. Come see us next week. Bottle full of bub, mama, I got what you need. If you need to feel the buzz, I'm into having sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, if you're into getting rough. You can find me in the club. Bottle full of bub, mama, I got what you need. If you need to feel the buzz, I'm into having sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, if you're into getting rough. This podcast is supported by the following advertisement. At Morgan Stanley, old school hard work meets bold new thinking. At 88 years old, we still see the world with the wonder of new eyes, helping you discover untapped possibilities and relentlessly working with you to make them real. Old school grit, new world ideas. Morgan Stanley. To learn more, visit morganstanley.com/yus. Investing involves risk. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC.